So today is August 21st, 2018, at Bhaktivedanta Menor, and we're going to be looking at what's called the Law of Expectation. So this seminar was derived from a book and seminar by a Christian teacher called Dr. Bruce Wilkinson, called The Seven Laws of the Learner. I actually learned this from him in person. I attended his seminars in person at least twice, maybe three times. And I've taught this. Actually, I taught the whole series, the whole seven laws, right here in this room many years ago. I also, at the request of my GBC peer, Krishna Swami, taught this whole seminar, all the seven laws, to pretty much all the devotees in his temple in Hillsborough, North Carolina. So it's basically what Dr. Wilkinson did was he studied the Bible to see how does God teach and how does Jesus teach. And I'm hoping that someday somebody will do that with the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita and say, what's the method that Krishna and the great devotees used to teach? So this particular method is that of what we're going to call blossoming people, of really inspiring people, helping people to be the best they can be. Actually, our goal in bhakti is to help people become the best of themselves, the best that they personally can be, the most ideal of themselves. Now, each of us is a unique individual. And Prabhupada says everyone has some extraordinary talent, and to serve Krishna with one's extraordinary talent means successful life. So this is basically a system of helping people to discover their ordinary talents and to feel enlivened in them. And I'm going to teach this to all of you so that you can help enliven each other as well as everybody that you come in contact with. I find it's one of the most needed things in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and in the world in general. And it's also something you can use, I'm sure, to enliven yourself, although it's really meant to be creating a culture of mutual appreciation. And that's what it's like in the spiritual world, in Vaikuntha. There's mutual appreciation. Prabhupada talks about this in the Bhagavatam, that everyone is always appreciating everyone else's service. The flowers with beautiful colors and exquisite fragrances are bowing down to Tulsi, who doesn't appear to have very spectacular colors or fragrance, because she's very dear to the Lord, and the sweetly singing birds, also of many colors, are offering their obeisances to the bees, which don't sing to sing as sweetly as the birds or be as beautiful as the birds, because there's this kind of appreciation of everyone else's service. So this is the type of society that we would like to have as devotees, one where we mutually appreciate each other, where anybody who comes to our society says, oh, I want to be part of that society, where people mutually appreciate each other. So we're going to be looking at how we can appreciate each other or how we can fail to appreciate each other through our expectations. So all of us have expectations all the time about everything. We have certain things that we expect about everyone that we meet, everything that we do, every place that we go. So this is the young woman expecting that some knight on a white horse is going to come and take her away. Right? Now, sometimes these expectations are a little unrealistic because the reality in time may be a little different. So the first principle here, or the second one really, the first one is that we all have expectations about everything all the time. The second is that what we expect of others, oh my, that's really off the screen, isn't it? Still like a little bit off the screen.
Yeah, maybe it's fine.
All right? The second principle is that what we expect of others impacts them. My expectation of other people has an effect on those people. We'll get into this more in depth. This is also what you privately think. You don't even have to say anything. So one example is placebo. Are you all familiar with the example of placebo? So do you know that 30% of the time, and our doctor, our resident doctor can correct me if I'm getting this wrong, doctors, so I believe 30% of the time, people will get better with a placebo. Placebo has no medicine in it. It's just inert, inactive. But because it's given to you by a doctor or a health professional who says this will make you better, about a third of people get better. Nobody really knows why. In fact, whenever they're testing a new medicine, they have one group that doesn't take any medicine, one group that takes a placebo, and one group that takes the real medicine. Because they want to eliminate any effect of the placebo. And again, nobody really knows why it works. And there's also what's called a nocebo effect, which means if you're told something's going to harm you, even if it isn't anything at all, then you may feel sick or you may feel disturbed because you believe it's going to harm you. So there's the effect in a school that if, you know, you're getting the new kids in at the beginning of the school year and the teacher from the previous year says, hey, this guy Tony, he's a bad kid. Then as soon as you see him, you're going to think, oh, he's a bad kid. And we have this among each other, right? There's someone we don't know. Oh, who is that? Oh, you know, I knew her. Oh, she's just so proud and she has so many problems and this and that. And then that's what we're expecting. Or, oh, this is a really nice person. That. So we're getting those expectations from others, which changes how we treat them. Or you can say, oh, here's an older Prabhupada disciple. Oh, this must be a very advanced person. It must be a very spiritually realized person. So Dr. Wilkinson told a story, when I went to his class, of his first year as a teacher in a Christian seminary. This is in a university. So maybe the first or second day on campus, one of the other professors went up to him and said, Bruce, I can't believe how lucky you are. You got section 2. They never give section 2 to the new professors. I don't know how you got section 2. He says, well, what's the section 2? What are you talking about? He said, section 2 are the kids from secondary school who were the top, top students in their class. They're basically the top in the country. This is the cream of the crop. They just practically pull that learning out of you. They're so enthusiastic. You'll see. You'll see what it's like. So Dr. Wilkinson thought, well, okay, I guess I'll see what it's like. And indeed he did. When he was teaching, he found that he enjoyed his other classes, he enjoyed his other students, but boy, that section too, they were so enthusiastic. Their work was of very high quality. He just really, really looked forward to being in that class. So about midway through the semester, he was walking to a faculty meeting, and the dean of the university was also walking and saw him. Oh, hi, Bruce, how do you like teaching this year? Oh, Dean, I really like it, and I can't believe that I got section 2. Wow, that is just amazing. Those students are incredible. And the dean stopped and he said, oh, tell me that. He said, well, they read not only what I assign, but more than that, they ask lots and lots of really deep questions in the class. The quality of their work is amazing. They just make teaching worthwhile. And the dean said, well, Bruce, this year we did something different. We took the high-performing kids and we scattered them among all the classes. We don't really have a special section 2 this year. So Dr. Wilkinson said that he was so stunned that he didn't even go to the faculty meeting. He said he went to the registrar's office and said, I'm teaching section 2, right? And she said, yeah. He said, that's the high-performing kids, right? She said, well, they always were, but this year we decided to try something new and we scattered them among all the classes. So then he went back to his office and he got out all the papers that he corrected that semester. And he stacked them up, and he saw that the papers from section 2, the stack was higher than all of his other classes put together. They'd done more work. And he looked in his grade book, And they'd gotten higher grades. Now, how did that happen? So where do our expectations come from? They come from our past experience. They influence what's happening right now. And they also impact what's happening in the future. Now, we expose our expectations to what we do and our attitude. So I'm sure Dr. Wilkinson never went to that class and said, "Wow, you guys are the smartest people in the school." But somehow, unconsciously, through his attitude and his actions, he interacted with them in such a way that they did far better than all of his other students. Now, when I used to work in a government school as an assistant head teacher, I would observe the other teachers and how they were dealing with their students. And then, especially for the younger kids, they would have different reading groups. So they would have the slow readers, the average readers, and then the really good readers. And when the teachers were working with the slow readers, they would lean back. When they were working with the really good readers, they would lean forward. When they were working with the slow readers, they wouldn't wait very long for them to answer a question. They'd ask them a question, they'd wait a little bit, and then they'd immediately give them the answer. With the faster readers, they'd ask them a question, they'd wait for them to answer, and if they didn't answer, they'd give them a hint. And then give them another hint. And then they'd wait some more. And then they'd give them another hint. And only after doing that for some time, if the student still didn't have the answer, would they give them the answer. And by the way, none of the teachers were aware that they were doing this. They were doing it unconsciously. Now, I had an experience when I was running a gurukul that Prabhupada said that we had to teach Sanskrit or it wasn't really gurukul. So I took that very, very seriously and always made sure we had a Sanskrit teacher. Well, at one point, I didn't have any Sanskrit teacher. And I said, well, all right, I guess I gotta learn Sanskrit myself. So I was taking a Sanskrit course, staying a few steps above the students, but I decided to do an immersion program. So I signed up for a 9-day Sanskrit camp. It was in a very remote area, there was no phone service, no internet, nothing. And we were supposed to speak Sanskrit all the time, although that didn't really happen. So on the first day, and there were 75 people there, and only 4 other of them were not Indians. So I was one of only 5 non-Indians. And the other 4 were all people who were married to Indians. So it was really kind of odd. Anyway, so on the first day, they said, okay, we're dividing into 3 classes. One class is for the beginners. These are people who don't know the Sanskrit alphabet. They don't know any Sanskrit grammar, nothing. I thought, well, I don't belong there because I've already been studying on my own for a couple of years. Then they said, we have the advanced class. Those are people who can actually speak in Sanskrit, although I definitely don't belong there. And then we have the intermediate group. They said, these are people who don't know any Sanskrit, but they know an Indian language. And I thought, okay, I don't know an Indian language, but I know some Sanskrit, so maybe I'll fit in there. So I went up to the teacher, who was, by the way, absolutely one of the best teachers I have ever seen or worked with ever in any capacity. Just an excellent, excellent teacher. And I went up to him at the beginning and I said, you know, I'm noticing that the people in this group, not only do they know an Indian language, but because most of these people grew up in India, in their school they also study Sanskrit. I said, so really in this group, everyone here knows just as much Sanskrit as I do, plus an Indian language. And he says, well, you know, we'll make sure that you're taken care of. So he had a mentality that I wasn't as good as the other students in his class. So what he would do is he would teach a grammatical construction, and then he would ask everyone to think of their own sentences, to make up their own sentences. So he's, you know, people are raising their hands, he's calling on them, and in my head I'm trying to form a sentence. And after I think I got it right, I'm kind of raising my hand like this. And right when I would be raising my hand, he would go on to the next thing. So I never got called on. Now, most of my life in school, I was a good student. I never had an experience in school where I felt incompetent or foolish. This was really my first experience with that. And I just felt so stupid. I mean, after like 2 days, I was thinking, why did I ever come? I never should have come here. What was I thinking? I started to wish that the ground would swallow me up. I wished that we had phone service and I could call my family and tell them I was going to change my ticket and come home early. I started getting really bad stomach aches. I started getting all these physical symptoms. And I just thought, this is useless. I never should have learned Sanskrit. I never should have thought I could have learned Sanskrit. So on day 7 of the 9 days, they switched the teachers. So the teacher from the advanced class came to teach our class. And I had never talked to him. He didn't know anything about me. As far as he was concerned, I was just another student in the class. So he started teaching pretty much the same way, but instead of waiting for us to raise our hands, he just called on us. Okay, here's the construction. You give one. You give one. You give one. I thought, oh my God, he's going to call on me. And he did. And guess what? What do you think happened when he called on me? I got it right. And when he called on me again, I got it right again. And when he called on me again, I got it right again. What I learned in those 9 days was not so much about Sanskrit, but about expectations. How we impact people through our expectations. Neither of those teachers said, I think you're competent, I think you're incompetent. They didn't say anything. And they treated me just very slightly differently. It was very slight, but it was enough to change my whole experience and my whole self-concept. I mean, not only did it change my experience of learning Sanskrit, but it changed how I thought about myself, how enthused I was, how inspired I was. All right, I have a little bit of a cold. So this is a very important principle, and I'd like us all to say it together. Expectations impair others if set too low or too high for too long. Again, expectations impair others if set too low or too high for too long. Again, expectations impair others if set too low or too high for too long. Now, it's natural that we may sometimes have expectations of others that are too low or too high. We're never going to have the perfect expectations of others all the time. But what we need to do is adjust. If I'm expecting too much of you, it's going to discourage you. And if I'm expecting too little of you, it's going to discourage you. So I need to be able to be flexible with my expectations of someone else and of myself to make sure that they're always going to be inspiring. Okay, now we're going to learn a method. And what we're going to be using the term blossom, or to bring out, you were saying in the beginning, that what we're trying to do is we're trying to help everyone become the ideal of themselves. To take their extraordinary talents and their personality and express that in the most ideal way. And you can think of that as blossoming, just like you have a seed and you want it to express its particular kind of flower in the best way. So now we're going to go through a method whereby we can consciously and deliberately use the power of expectation to inspire others. So the first thing you want to do is you want to examine somebody. Now, most of the time, we don't really pay attention to other people. We're paying attention to ourselves. Our awareness is in ourselves. We generally don't really notice what other people do. And what you want to notice with other people is you want to notice facts. you want to notice facts. So let's give some. Now, it's very important to distinguish between a fact and one's understanding or interpretation of that fact. So, for example, if somebody doesn't pick up their rubbish, that's a fact. That person is lazy. Is my judgment about the fact. Is that clear? Or that person is irresponsible is my judgment about the fact. And there's a big difference between noticing facts and noticing my judgment about them. So our tendency is that when we do notice what other people do, it tends to be in terms of our judgment about it rather than the thing. So you could say our interpretation, our story. So I'm sure that all of you have read or watched some detective story, right? Some mystery story. Thank you. Where, you're presented with a bunch of facts and you think, oh, okay, the butler did it and actually it was somebody else, right? Because you were interpreting, of course, the author or the director was trying to get you to misinterpret them, but you were interpreting them wrong. And I'm sure you've heard about this, in the real world, that there'll be some crime committed, and the police think, oh, this is what happened, this is what happened, this is what happened, and actually it turned out that the story was different, yes? And in our own lives, right, has someone ever misinterpreted your actions? Have you ever misinterpreted somebody else's actions? Right, so we're telling a story or an interpretation about what happened that's different than what happened. So let's just give a couple of examples, some people, some examples. I talked about leaving rubbish on the ground. Can you think of positive or negative things? Give me a fact and then a possible interpretation. Yes?
You might say something, and the other person just respond.
Also an interpretation. Yeah. So the person doesn't answer. An interpretation could be they didn't hear. What else could be an interpretation?
They're ignoring.
Yeah, they're ignoring. Okay. Or they don't care. Okay, I'm going to give you another example.
Someone shouted.
Okay. And what could be an interpretation of that?
You're an angry person.
Angry person, okay. We can also have some positive ones here. We can have somebody gives me a gift. What could be an interpretation?
The generous.
The generous.
Like me.
Mm-hmm. Like me. Somebody think of another example?
Someone responds confidently and you assume they might know what they're talking about.
Somebody does what?
Responds quite confidently.
Oh, okay. Even confidently is kind of a funny word.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So how can we talk about confidently as a factual thing?
Loudly and boldly.
Okay, let's say eye contact, no hesitation,
even boldly is a little bit of an adjective.
Someone likes reading.
Fact.
Someone's clever.
This is hard, by the way. What?
Clever. Someone's clever.
Well, instead of they like reading, a fact is something that you can measure with a camera or a microphone.
If they are reading.
Or why don't we say they read 3 books a week? That would be a fact. And then a story would be they like reading. Any other possible interpretations?
Smart.
Yeah. They're smart.
They have to be stupid.
Somebody's forcing them. Okay.
Someone's using that something nice or is wearing something nice and assuming they're wealthy.
Okay, so instead of nice, which is also here, expensive?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes? You say someone's using their phone, and that has multiple, you know, it might be an emergency, it could be that. They're inattentive to their surroundings. They're not.
Maybe they have lots of friends. Maybe they have lots of work.
Maybe they're taking notes.
Maybe they're taking notes. That reminds me, Sachinanda Maharaj once told the story that when he was giving class, there were a couple people at the back of the room talking the whole time. And he said he just found it extremely annoying. And as he was giving the class, he was feeling more and more and more and more annoyed as the class was going on. And after the whole class was over, he went up to them and said, "Why were you talking during the whole class?" They said, "No, Maharaj, I was translating." But I've run into that one. Do you have to use your phone? Oh, I'm taking notes. This is a very essential piece. Maybe I should tell you why it's so important, and then maybe you could also do some work on your own. So the reason that this is so important is that when I'm responding to my judgments about other people, first of all, my judgments or my stories about them could be wrong. Yeah? Right? And if somebody tries to encourage me or inspire me by giving me their judgment about me, I often won't accept it because it's often wrong. Or it just doesn't fit with my view of myself. Even if it's correct, if maybe I'm a person who really needs to be inspired and I have kind of a low opinion of myself, if you just tell me your judgment about me, I'm not going to accept it. If I think that I'm lazy and inattentive and spaced out, and you say to me, "You know, you are just so attentive and responsible," I'll think, "You have no idea." And I won't accept it. I won't take it on. And in fact, the way I'll respond to that is feeling that the person's trying to manipulate me in some way. I'm thinking, well, they want something from me. So whenever we start out with our story about someone or our judgment about someone, even if it's entirely positive, the other person will have difficulty digesting it. They'll think, "Well, why are you saying that? And what's your basis?" They may not say that, but they'll be thinking, "What's your basis for saying that? Why are you saying that?
do you want something from me? And it doesn't really go internal. But if what you notice is a fact, people can't argue with facts. Now, if I say, thank you very much for bringing me a plate of prasadam, what are they going to say? I didn't bring you a plate of prasadam? Yeah. I mean, sometimes because devotees have all this idea that they're supposed to be really humble, they'll say, oh, I didn't really do anything. And then I just say, well, thank you for not doing anything. It was wonderful, not anything. I was absolutely delicious, not anything. And then they can't argue about it anymore, and they accept it. You understand? But if I said, thank you for being so considerate, they might, you know, that you can argue about. Well, am I considerate? Am I not considerate? But bringing me a plate of prasadam, that's not something you can argue about. If I say, you know, wow, you've come to all of the Pandavasena girls' meetings for the last 3 months, that's just a fact. If I say, wow, you're really inspired to be part of the Pandavasena, who knows? Maybe you are, maybe you aren't. Maybe you're coming to the meetings for some other reason, who knows? So the first thing that we want to notice about people are facts. Now, I would also suggest that we try to notice facts not so much about results, because we're not able to completely control the results of what we do, right? What we can control is our effort, our sacrifice, our giving, yes? That we have a lot of control over, but we don't really have that much control over how things turn out. So if someone just says, wow, that was a lovely dramatic performance, or it was a beautiful dance, you know, there's also a part of us that thinks, well, thankfully I didn't mess up. But I've messed up before. Or, you know, you didn't see that mess up, I didn't seem to. Mm-hmm. Isn't that like that? It wasn't really as good as what it was supposed to be. What we really want to be appreciated for is the background sacrifice that we make. Could I get some more water? Okay. Maybe like another cup in addition to that one would be helpful. Sorry, my throat's bothering me today. So the kind of thing we really want to be appreciated for and that really helps us blossom is things like, well, you know, I guess you practiced for the last 2 weeks. Or, you know, I noticed you here every day at 3 o'clock practicing with the other students. Something like that that indicates the person's sacrifice and the person's giving. Because that's what we all want to be noticed for, and we practically never are. I mean, I had an experience just recently, actually, with one ISKCON leader. Thank you. Who attended a meeting that I was part of. And he was complaining about being a leader and complaining that, you know, people just criticize him. So I just started listing the kind of things that I assumed that he did. It wasn't things I could have observed, but I just assumed. I said, well, you know, you're probably dealing with a lot of legal issues with different ISKCON temples and people trying to take over a temple. And, you know, conflicts between leaders in a temple and trying to regulate sannyasis. And I started listing all of these different things that I understood that he was doing. And he said, oh, this list, now I really want to quit all these difficult things that I'm doing. And I said, but you're all doing it. You're doing it all in the service of Prabhupada. And he looked at me and he said, you know, if we weren't devotees, I'd go over and hug you. And I thought, probably nobody ever says anything like this. You know, all anybody ever does is criticize. And again, I didn't talk about his results. I didn't say, you know, you've published this and you've done this. And I said, these are the sacrifices you're making. These are the difficult situations that you're dealing with. And he was just so immensely grateful. So in order to say this, we have to notice. So the second step is you actually say what the person has done. But first you have to notice. And it takes some training, it takes some deliberation to notice what are other people doing. Like, oh, I see you're taking some notes. I see you're sitting there listening and alert. You're not falling asleep, even though the room is a little stuffy. So to just notice. Does this make sense to everybody? I notice that you always take care of the flower decorations. I notice that you've been, you know, you've distributed 10 books every week for the last month. Well, whenever I see you, you're chanting japa. Or whenever I talk to you, you're telling me something you've read in Prabhupada's books. I was just recently with a family where practically everything they said was out of Prabhupada's books. And I said something to them. I said, you know, I think it's like 75%, 80% of what you say. It just sounds like you're repeating the books. So to be able to say that to people. All right, what I would like you to do is just, don't take too long, we'll take like 3 or 4 minutes. Just work with, say, 2 or 3 people. If you really don't like working with other people, you can do it by yourself, but it's better if you work with somebody else. And see if you can make your own list like this. And try to avoid any word in your fact list that has any kind of judgment. You know, most of our adjectives, most of our adverbs are giving some sort of judgment. Just facts. Facts is something that you can get with a camera or a microphone. So something you can see with a camera or a microphone. So perhaps you've learned this, you know, when you're in school and you're being taught how to write stories, how to write narratives, and they say show rather than tell. Right? Have you heard that from your teachers? Like you're not going to write, Susie came in the door angry. You say, Susie came in the door and closed it so hard that the door jamb shook. Now, then she took her bag and threw it on the couch. She then sat down so heavily and so swiftly in the chair that the chair started shaking. She pounded her fists on the chair and said very loudly, I hate them. Right? Those are facts. So a judgment is, she's angry. Right? Maybe she's upset. Maybe she's scared, I don't know. Those are judgments. But the facts are what she did. So a fact could be, oh, you made sure that everybody in the room had a cushion. You made sure there was water for everybody. You know, you came to do your kitchen service on time. You went out and distributed books on Saturday and you distributed 15 books. Those are facts. Is that getting a little bit there? Okay, so just take just a few minutes, 3 or 4 minutes, work with one or with 2 people or with 3 people, and just make your own list like that. The difference being a fact and an interpretation about that. That your first sort of inclination was to interpret. Like, wait a minute, what facts am I interpreting? All right. Anybody else? What was challenging about this? Yeah?
Including that judgment or interpretation, like what do you do with that information? Like, I said all these things.
Anybody else? Or any other feedback? What did you find easy about it? Or what did you find revealing about doing this? Yeah?
Just on this observation, it's very easy to like make an interpretation, but it's hard to actually state facts. Like, think about facts.
Yes, it is definitely harder. Yes?
I think like once you're faced with a fact, you actually kind of see how many reasons that could be behind it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Yes, once you get to the fact, all of a sudden you realize, hey, wait a minute, there could be 15 different interpretations of this fact. In fact, someone just asked me that the other day about a particular devotee, a particular circumstance happened some years ago. And he asked me, what happened? So I told him what happened, and then he said, why do you think it happened? And I said, well, here's my most charitable interpretation, here's my least charitable interpretation, and who knows what there is somewhere in between. All right. So then we want to be able to say to people, now it's good if you can say it when somebody's doing something. Oh, you just cleaned up all the flowers from Prabhupada's Vyasa. Or I noticed you just helped that person find a seat. Or I noticed you went in and welcomed that guest that's coming. I noticed you come for the last 3 days and you've just been chanting japa. So to actually express that to somebody. And again, you want to make sure you only express facts. That you only express facts. The next thing is how you feel about it. Yes.
But in your experience, have you not felt that sometimes if you do present your judgment and it's something that you think the other person can resonate with because it's come out of an action that they've repeated a few times? For example...
We'll get there.
Okay.
We'll get to how to express your judgment in a way that is empowering to others. So the next thing is emotion. That makes me feel, or I feel. Well, I noticed you put up all the flower decorations for the festival. That makes me feel really excited. Try to not have it just be happy and sad. It's also good to get an emotion vocabulary. This tonight, but you can look up what are the words that describe emotions. This is another area that we tend to be rather deficient in. Now we don't really have names for how we're feeling. It makes me curious. It makes me excited. It makes me feel inspired. It makes me feel hopeful. Now, here is where you can give your interpretation. Well, I believe that you're becoming. Now, the reason why I believe that you're becoming, it's my opinion. I'm not telling you that you are. I'm telling you it's my belief. You are becoming is very different from you are also. I believe you are becoming. It doesn't have to be those exact words, but wow, it looks like you're becoming a really dedicated servant of the deities. It's very different from you are a dedicated servant of the deities. Because as soon as I say you are, then immediately the person is going to think, well, no, I'm not. You should have seen me last night. You should have seen me when I was asked to, you know, make the ghee-wicks. Actually, I'd much rather play a game on my phone. You know, they're going to think of all these reasons why what you're saying is not true. Or if they accept what you said, it may just make them proud. Oh, yes, I'm a very dedicated servant. Which isn't going to be helpful for them either. But wow, you're really becoming a valuable member of the Hare Krishna. Becoming serious about your spiritual life. That's much easier to digest. All right, now this is important. Whatever we say they're becoming needs to be in the positive, not you're becoming a lazy bum. There may be some place for that, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. Something that the other person would want. You have to know them a little bit. And it's got to be broad enough so that they'll accept it. Because if it's too specific, they may think, well, no, it's not exactly like that. But specific enough that it's related to that particular circumstance. So it's a really simple thing. Oh, I see you've all been sitting here since at least 7:30. Some of you came a little bit late. And you've all been listening, and many of you have been taking notes. that makes me feel very inspired and enlivened to teach you this when I see that you're attentive. I believe that you're becoming people who can inspire others. It's just that simple. It's not a very difficult thing. So I made it specific enough to the circumstance, but vague enough so you could make your own reality out of it. You always want, when you want to inspire someone else, you want to inspire them in a way that you're actually just helping them to inspire themselves. But you're giving them permission and you're giving them a framework in which they can inspire themselves. Because none of us really fully knows what another person needs and what another person can become. We just don't. Often we don't even know what we need, what we can become. We certainly don't really know what somebody else needs. So we want to put it in broad enough terms that it's acceptable to them. And then the last one is not always appropriate. But the last one is something nonverbal. You look at someone, or you smile at them, or you touch them, or you give them a hug. So obviously this is not always appropriate. But in situations where it is appropriate. So how old are you?
14.
Okay. So even though you're one of the younger members here, I noticed that you've been sitting and listening the whole time. So that makes me feel very hopeful that, you know, even the young members of the Pandavasena can be enthusiastic about learning how to be inspiring to others. So I believe that if you keep studying this, especially studying it starting at a young age, it'll just become a natural part of who you are. You'll just do it even without thinking. That's it. Now, by the way, if you do this, is it possible to do this and not be genuine? It's possible to do anything and not be genuine, I suppose. But it's very hard to do this and not be genuine. It's very, 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 very difficult to follow these 5 points and not be genuine. Because it starts with really paying attention to somebody else. Now again, it's possible. You know, obviously, twisted, demoniac people can twist anything and manipulate, use anything to manipulate somebody else. But inspiring people like this tends to be non-manipulative. It tends to be genuine. And when you practice this, it tends to make you genuinely appreciate others. It's a really great cure for being critical of other people. Because it's very, very hard to do this without appreciating others. Whereas when you just simply praise people using interpretations, it's extremely easy to be insincere about it. It doesn't take any thought. You know, oh, you're such a great devotee. It doesn't take any thought. I don't have to pay any attention to you. I don't have to notice what you're doing. I don't have to know anything about you. Right? So I can easily speak like that without anything genuine myself. Nor did that do anything for you? Nothing. But did that do something for you when I talked to you? Yes. So it isn't such a complicated thing. You know, when we talk about we should care about each other, you know, what does that mean? I mean, sometimes it means something on the physical level. You know, you're sick and I should help take care of your health, or I should get you a cup of water, or I should get you a chair, or I should carry your bag for you, or something. Or you're really upset about something and I should just be there and give you a hug. But on another level, it means paying attention to people. Noticing what are people doing. And again, we generally don't do this. We generally don't notice what other people do. And especially if it's behind the scenes. I mean, another just really simple example. So I was in Rijeka, Croatia. And the first night that I'd come there, I had a presentation that needed a projector, but nobody had set up a projector. Somehow the communications got crossed, and so I gave the presentation without a projector, but it was the sort of presentation that really, really needed the visuals. And, you know, I knew that even though I worked really hard, I had to work about 3 or 4 times as hard as I usually do, still the presentation was just kind of like meh. You know, and the whole time I was like, I wish I had the night. That was all pictures. I wish I had the pictures. And even afterwards, one of the organizers said, you know, we were expecting something a little, and I'm like, well, you know, I didn't have, you wanted me to give my presentation anyway, even though I didn't have everything together. So the next night, one of the devotees did set up a projector. And afterwards, I said to him, you know, I noticed that you set up the projector, you set up the screen, you make sure I had some place for the books. You know, I listed all the things that he did. And he just got this big smile on his face, and then he looked at me and said, and I wasn't even the one who was supposed to do it. He said it was actually someone else's job. And I said, wow, and you did it when it wasn't even your job. Now that's another thing that I've noticed, that when you start paying attention to what people are doing, they'll tell you things that you should notice. We get so excited, oh wow, somebody actually notices something that I'm doing. And we get all excited. We'll say, oh, and I also did this. Oh, and I did that. No? So that was just something very interesting. I also visited a temple, I won't say where, many years ago, where the devotees were just fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting. So they asked me, I'm trained in mediation, they asked me to do some mediation. And I said, well, first, why don't we work on some appreciation? So we got these devotees sitting in a circle, and I mean, there were even lawyers there, not just devotees who happened to be lawyers. It was a very contentious, tense situation. So we just went around the room, and I said, I want everybody to talk about what other people do, and just facts, and I wouldn't let it be stories, it all had to be facts. It took us 2 hours for everybody to just say some positive fact about everybody else. And afterwards, one of the lawyers, who's not a devotee, came up to me and said, this is the most positive meeting we've had in 2 years. It just immediately changed the whole atmosphere. So let's put this up here because we're going to want to reference it. Maybe the red one will work. Okay. So the first thing is to notice, to examine, and to express. Then, what is the next one? Next one? And the next? Now, like everything else, once you practice this, it actually becomes a part of you. So the first thing is to purposely take advantages of opportunities. When you have a chance where you actually see and hear what people are doing, take advantage of it to inspire them. And be creative. It doesn't always have to be something you say to someone. It can be a note you write to someone. It can be a phone call. It can be sending them something. One of the nicest things that I ever got from somebody was somebody here in London. It was a little note that was given to me at the end of one of my classes that was like this. It was this kind of encouragement. And I was so inspired that I actually copied it into my journal. Something I would go back and read again, you know, to inspire myself. It was just, you know, and obviously you can understand I get both compliments and criticisms all the time. And most of them, frankly, I don't pay much attention to, either the compliments or the criticisms. But when I got something that was very specific and helpful like that, it was something I could turn to again and again and again. I remember another one that that I got. This was a phone call, one of my godbrothers. And he said, "Ermila, you're like a cork." I said, "How is that?" He said, "Well, I noticed that every time there's some difficulty, you pop back up again." And he'd been helping with our Gurukul, and he started listing it. He said, you know, you had this problem with the finances and you were building the building. He was going through all these different things, and he said, every time you picked yourself back up again and you kept going. He said, "She always reminded me of a quote." So pick your words very precisely. Again, you want to describe what people are doing. If you are going to use eye contact, look at people directly, again, when it's appropriate. Remember that we express expectations in body language and not just in words. So think about these examples that I gave of where expectations, positive and negative expectations, were expressed indirectly. If it's appropriate to use touch, and do expect the best from us. Now, by the way, you can also use this with yourself. You can also use this with yourself. If you're feeling discouraged or down about yourself, you can also look at facts. Okay, let's see. I've done this, said this, did this. That makes me feel hopeful. I believe I am becoming better at this. Something. But you can also do this for yourself. All right, let's look at some examples from Srila Prabhupada. So he says, "My dear Upendra, please accept my blessings. I am so..." He doesn't always do this in the same order, but all the elements are there. "I am so glad to hear that you are released now. This I expected when you came to see me. I entrusted the matter to Krishna to give you release. Anyway, Krishna has been so much merciful upon you that he has taken you out of the state laws. So in every kind of miseries, we have to depend on Krishna, and we should not be too much disturbed when such miseries come upon us. You have shown very great example in sticking yourself to chanting Hare Krishna while you were in tribulation. Follow this practice all along your life, and surely Krishna will accept you into the kingdom of God, back to God." Okay, so what did Srila Prabhupada express? Anybody tell me what specific fact did Srila Prabhupada note? Obviously, this was a devotee who was put into jail. Yes? He was chanting regularly even when he was in prison. Okay. What emotion did Prabhupada express? He's happy, said, "I'm glad." Yes. And he also talked about that he had expected this. In other words, he was expressing indirectly that he had been very hopeful. Okay. And what is he saying? "I believe you are becoming." What's his expressing his interpretation in a positive way.
Showing a great example.
Mm-hmm. And then the other one. He's expressing some future hope. Yes. So of course he qualifies it. Follow this all along your life, and surely Krishna will accept you into the kingdom of God, back to God. So, you chanted Hare Krishna even when you were in prison. That made me very happy. And actually, I had this expectation that you would do this. Right? If you keep doing this, I'm sure that you will go back to home, back to God. Okay, here's another one. Also to Upendra. "Your strong desire to serve me is very beautiful. Your serving me means serving Krishna. I am also your servant. So I cannot accept your service from you or from any of my disciples. I accept service from my disciples on behalf of Krishna." Now, here we can't see exactly what prompted this. It must have been a letter from him expressing some strong desire. So here Prabhupada is responding to some expression of his strong desire to serve him. And then what emotion is he saying? And he's saying it indirectly. Yes, it's very beautiful. So Prabhupada's not really talking, you know, he's not expressing, I feel full of wonder, but he's indirectly expressing an emotion. And what is he saying here that he's expecting? We're saying here that it means serving Krishna, that you are therefore serving Krishna. I see this, you have a strong desire to serve me. The way I feel about this, I feel it's a very beautiful thing. And I can see that this is bringing you to serve Krishna. Okay, this is one to Jamuna. But I'm very much happy for your nice spiritual sentiments. In London, there may be a temple or not, it does not matter. You are doing very nicely more than having a temple. If Krishna gives us a better temple, that is all right. Otherwise, your engagement in Kirtan is very, very nice. So continue this program in cooperation with your other God brothers and sisters, and Krishna will make you very happy. You six together are doing so nicely that I am very much proud of you. Be blessed by Lord Sri Chaitanya and go on like this. So what specific actions is he looking at? Kirtan? Hmm?
Cooperation.
But that's not it. We're not sure how specific that is, but definitely Kirtan. And what about nice spiritual sentiments? Again, she must have written something to him that he's responding to. And how does that make him feel?
Proud.
Yes, it makes him feel very proud. And what is he seeing for the future? Krishna will make you very happy. I thank you very much for installing Radha Giridhari, this Devaktadas. From my childhood, I was very much fond of Radha Krishna, and now my good disciples are helping me to open so many Radha Krishna temples all over the world. It gives me so much pleasure. Now introduce Rath Yatra. That was my childhood activity. I want to see my disciples all over the world introduce two items, opening Radha Krishna temples and Rath Yatra festivals. Do this under the protection of Guru Gauranga. Please do everything cooperatively, for you will be happy, your country will be happy, and all living entities will be happy. Okay, so what specific thing? Installing Radha Giridhari. And how did he feel? Gave me so much pleasure. Right? And then he's talking about some other specific things he can do to do Rath Yatra. And what is he seeing for the future? Nobody will come forward, and everybody will be happy. I believe you and everyone else will be happy. All right, this is a letter to Taitreya. I have studied your activities while in Honolulu, and it gives me great pleasure to find out such a devotee, that's a typo, qualified as you are in our society. I wish you will execute responsibilities in the future in the matter of our society's multi-activities. So here he's not listing the specific ones. Again, we just have this particular letter. But he's talking about her specific activities, which we assume he talked to her about. And how does he feel? Great pleasure. And what does he see her doing going forward? Executing great responsibilities. Executing responsibilities in our multi-activities, okay? I've studied your statements in the papers, and you have repeated my ideas at the same time sounded like a politician. And this combination is very effective. This was to Amarendra, who was running for public office. You are certainly the right man for this preaching work. They have taken you as a serious candidate, and according to your statement, you feel you may even win. So I'm very much encouraged by this political field in America. The people there are very intelligent, and they take your statement seriously. I do not need to tell you to push on with this work in serious concentration, because I see you are already very determined. So what specific things is he noticing? Statements in the papers. And he's very specific about it. He's saying, you repeated what I've said, but you repeated what I said as a politician. So he's very, very specific. And then what is he saying he's feeling? Well, but his emotions?
Encouraged.
I feel very encouraged. And then what is he doing with going forward? That he may win, that he's very determined, that he's the right person. So why do you think some of us, sometimes we expect the worst of other people? We assume the worst of other people, we expect the worst of other people. Any thoughts? Okay, people have done it to us.
We try to form patterns, and if we felt that we've been disappointed by that person before, we expect that again.
Okay.
Because when people show gratitude to us, it's that way part when actually we weren't really that, so we kind of expect other people aren't really.
Okay.
Like you said before, somebody has told us
about some negative thing about the person. Okay. Sometimes I think we're trying to protect ourselves. We're not having too high expectations. But remember, expectations should neither be too high nor too low for too long. So we're not trying to have such high expectations of people that they can't meet it and become discouraged. But we want to be able to have expectations that move people a little bit higher than they are now. Does that make sense? Okay, so why don't we do this? Why don't you get in pairs and you can do something, if you know each other, you can do something with each other. And if you don't know each other, then you can role play and pretend that the person is somebody else. Takes 30 seconds to 1 minute to go through this. So go into pairs, and each person, please practice this with the other. So, any final questions or thoughts on this? Yes?
It's easy for interpretation to build without any one of those E's. So you do have to be really mindful when you're doing.
Yes, once you practice this like anything else, then it becomes much more automatic. You know, and the beauty of the system is even if you do it mechanically, it has to be somewhat genuine. It's very, very difficult to do this even mechanically without feeling some genuine appreciation for the other person. Yes? Is it? It's just extremely difficult. I'm sure it's possible if you're really a weirdo, but you know. It almost forces you to actually feel appreciative. So even if you're doing it mechanically and hesitantly or whatever, it still is very effective and the other person feels very nurtured. And of course, the more you practice it, the more it just becomes part of who you are. It just becomes part of who you are. It becomes part of how you deal with each other. And just imagine if we all dealt with each other like this on a regular basis, how attractive our society would be to ourselves also. And to others. Any other thoughts? Feedback? Yes?
I just had a question. I don't know if I've got it right, but one of the parenting books or something, it talked about naming an emotion. I see you're feeling angry, or I see you're feeling frustrated. How would that tie? Am I right in thinking that? Are there.
That sort of thing, naming an emotion in this particular, what we're talking about here, is good for yourself. That you're able to name your emotions instead of just like happy or sad.
So would that mean that if you're dealing with a child, would you either choose one method or the other? It seems a bit contradictory.
Well, yeah, a toolbox has lots of different tools in it. So you're not going to go around inspiring people every minute of every day. That would be a little weird. Depending on what's going on in a particular circumstance. I mean, this is something that I try to do. First of all, I try to notice what people do. This is something that I do when I particularly notice somebody doing something that probably no one else notices and that I see as somewhat out of the ordinary. And it's something I try to do at least once or twice a day with somebody.
Especially if it was easy to do that with people that you knew, but if you didn't know them so well, your expectation was just, I would be continuing to do Mm. So it might be more effective in some ways.
That you do know. Well, this works best when you really do know somebody and you really paid attention to them. Which speaks to the fact that it's good that we know, if we know each other, that we actually know something about each other. By the way, people can even live in the same house and not really notice what the other people in their house do. They may notice what the other people in their house do that annoys them. No, but they're not really paying attention to what the other person does that's important to the other person and what the other person would like to have noticed and like to have appreciated. Which is a very, very different thing. Does that make sense? But it's something that needs to be done intentionally. For most of us, it doesn't just come automatically. So yes, it's difficult to do this with people that you don't know well. But that is definitely true. You can still do it to some extent. Because I believe you're becoming, or, you know, sometimes that's not a particularly appropriate wording, depends on your relationship with the person. Like I was saying, I was talking to this GBC person, and the way I did that is, and it's all being done in the service of Prabhupada's lotus feet. That's what I did. In that way, it wouldn't be appropriate for me to say, I believe you are becoming. It would sound too much like I was his authority or something. It wouldn't have worked. And I could say that it was general enough, you know. If you just say, I believe you're becoming a nice person, that's way too general. It can't be so general that it's meaningless, but it's got to be general enough so that the person, as I say, can find their own reality in it. And to some extent, you can do that even if you don't know people well, but the better you know somebody, the better you're able to do it. Any other thoughts? Does anyone know how long it takes for something to become a natural habit? Well, they say usually about 21 days. So about 3 to 4 weeks. Anything you do for about 3 to 4 weeks tends to become a habit. Tends to become who you are. So I would suggest that you practice this. Try to practice this at least once a day with somebody. At least to some extent, if you can't do all the steps with everybody, at least somebody. And to also try to make a general habit when you're dealing with others to separate your interpretation from what's observable with a camera and a microphone. Doing that will make you a much happier person. You will get along with others better. They will get along with you better. You'll be much more peaceful.
But what do you do if you can't plan a good action?
It's very unusual. It'd be a very unusual circumstance where you can't find any good action. I mean, even in the Bhagavatam, the big demons had some good actions. I mean, Krishna found a good action in Putana. She was killing babies, for goodness sake. He still was able to find some good action. So it'd be a pretty rare person where there's no good action that you can find.
I mean,
as in,
like, do you then find, like, a good sentiment, or, like,
a... Yeah, but a sentiment is then your interpretation. If you really can't find any good action, somebody probably leaves them alone. Don't say anything. But if you really look, you can find something, because pretty much everybody does something that's good. You know, even mass murderers will be nice to their dog or something. You know, there's something that most people do that has some value that can be encouraged. And in fact, one of the ways that in many, not in all cases, but one of the ways in some cases that really, you know, evil criminal people get turned around is exactly that. Somebody notices something they do that's good and encourages that. And it doesn't always work, but it's something that has turned around even, you know, really people who really do evil things.
I'm going to try and formulate this the right way, but in general, women have a lot of emotions, and those emotions need to come out.
So as far as I know, men also have a lot of emotions.
But women's emotions sometimes need to be heard a little bit more. So they might be expressing their interpretation or their story. Can you use this technique to then not make a mountain out of a molehill?
Definitely, but I mean, frankly, I find that there's no gender difference between how much people rely on interpretation rather than facts. The tendency to think my interpretation of what happened is the same as what happened, I don't find to be gender specific at all. Actually, to believe that my interpretation of what happened is ignoring what we learn all the time, that we have imperfect senses, we make mistakes, we can be illusion, and we have a tendency to cheat. And I think it's kind of astonishing that in our Hare Krishna movement, it's one of the first things we learn. I have imperfect senses, I'm illusion, I make mistakes, I have a tendency to cheat, right? One of the first things we learn, one of the four defects of the conditioned soul. And yet, having learned that, we will still speak and behave as if how I understand reality and reality are exactly the same. Which, even if you weren't a Hare Krishna devotee, doesn't make the slightest bit of sense. To say, I believe that how my story about facts and the facts are the same. There's no difference. There's just, all the evidence of the world is against that. You don't have to be a spiritual person to see that. And that this is a problem that I think men and women have in equal measure, confusing one's interpretation. In fact, men can think, well, I'm so logical, and therefore my logical interpretation must be right. So, you know, it's just... Anyway, I know plenty of men who are more emotional than plenty of women. I see there's a general difference, but it's not on an individual level. It's not exactly right. Generally, conditioned souls take it that how I perceive the world is the world. You know, my story about your motives, and my story about your character, and my story about your desires is the reality. Although I don't believe that your story about me is the reality. So this is another, like, you know, practical humility, that the way I interpret the world and the world are not the same thing. In fact, they're very rarely the same. And they will often argue about our differing interpretations of something, each of us thinking we're talking about facts. You just don't care. I care. Well, what are we talking about? We're talking about, did you call? You know, you were going to be an hour late and you didn't call. What does that mean? It's when I was trained in supervising teachers, one of the things we discussed was that many times when employers supervise employees, they just have a checklist that's all subjective. You know, you're good at this, you're good at that, you're good at this. It's all evaluative. And we were trained to supervise teachers just by noting facts. Just by having a list of observable behaviors. So, we all ready to practice this? Yes? And if you mess up, that's fine. We're allowed to mess up as we learn, and even after we've learned, we may mess up sometimes. But the more that you put this into practice, the more that you'll, as I say, find this becoming part of you. You'll find that it's again, a lot easier to get along with others. They'll find a lot easier to get along with you. And there's another really, really interesting thing with the way the world works. And that is what we give out, we get back. The way that the universe is set up by Krishna is what we get back is what we're giving out. So when we give out appreciation, when we give out inspiring people through having higher expectations, then we also will tend to feel more inspired in life. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.